Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, we're going to talk about politics and cognitive science.
Ooh, politics and cognitive science. Cool. We're going to talk about how the politics can help us get more funding for cognitive science. That's really important, Ken.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be very philosophical, and that's not our topic, John. We're going to talk about how cognitive science, how the insights of cognitive science can help us understand politics and political decision-making.
Well, big deal. I mean, cognitive science is basically the science of thinking. There's no mystery there. We have values. Politicians have positions. The wise voter reads up on the positions, sees which politicians will promote his or her values, and votes accordingly. What's the big deal?
Boy, John, you're naive. It's a good thing you're not running for political office and are stuck in your ivory tower, because you'd never make it. Voters' minds don't work like that. It's not that simple.
What do you mean?
Well, suppose a politician says he's in favor of, let's say, tax relief. What comes to your mind?
Well, that sounds like a great idea, especially right now at tax time. Paying taxes is painful. It makes you lose sleep as well as money. We should be relieved of paying things that are painful. I like any politician who's going to relieve my pain.
But now look what's happened. Look how your thinking has gone. The word relief triggered a slew of associations in your mind. It represented taxation as a kind of affliction, like a bad rash or cancer or tuberculosis. It evoked a kind of metaphor, taxation as affliction. And your reaction wasn't really all that rational, because it didn't have anything to do with the real nature of taxation, which is basically about paying the bill for government services that we demand.
Well, I guess you've got a point there. Is the phrase tax relief, is that what politicians call spin?
You could call it that, but it goes deeper than that, at least according to many cognitive scientists. It's about framing.
Framing, I've heard of that.
Yeah, that has to do with the basic way we think. I mean, words often evoke a whole slew of scenarios in our minds, which come with kind of built-in roles and values. So take the word relief. It suggests this unfair burden. It also suggests a person who is burden, that's you, the taxpayer, and then a person who's there to relieve the burden, that's the politician.
Well, you know, now that you mentioned framing, I mean, it's all coming back to me, because in my classes we've studied about how you frame your concept of time in terms of your concept of space. Sometimes it's helpful, sometimes it's misleading. I guess the relief metaphor is like that. I mean, there is something right about it, but it can be very misleading. Here's another one. I'll just see if I'm any good at this. How about socialized medicine?
What does that make me think of? Well, it evokes images, frankly, of people in Eastern Europe before the fall of communism standing in line to get a loaf of bread because, you know, the government that controlled the means of production and distribution screwed everything up. And when I think of that with medicine, I think of myself waiting months and months to see my doctor. Who would want that?
Yeah, see, now we got an irrational response on your part, Ken, because I got sick in France once, where they have so-called socialized medicine. I saw a doctor the same day. I spent half an hour looking for where to pay my bill until someone explained to me there wasn't going to be a bill. You know, both of our examples, however, tax relief and socialized medicine, seem to evoke frames that push us towards conservative policies. Don't progressives have any frames they can evoke?
Well, you just use one sort of a little bit, the word progressive, substituting for the word liberal. But, you know, our guest, George Lakoff, says that the conservative think tanks have really mastered the art of using political language and images to evoke frames, while the progressives or liberals have lagged way, way behind. I mean, basically, the Republicans are really good at this, and the Democrats, well, pretty much suck.
We're going to start our discussion by talking about the general idea of how we think in metaphors and frames.
Then we'll move on to the role of the unconscious and metaphorical thought in political decision-making.
From then, we'll look at the ethics of framing in politics. Should we teach people to be more rational, or should we teach people to frame things better so they can promote their own values or our own values?
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Cornelli, gives us a local angle on framing and political decision-making. She files this report.
There's three components to any campaign. There's message, mechanics, and money.
When Democrats around here want to get elected, they hire Jim Ross. He's a political consultant. His job is to know exactly what it takes to get votes.
You can have a very compelling message, but if you can't raise money to buy television commercials or buy direct mail, it makes it very difficult to get that message out to a wide range of folks.
Ross is known for leading Gavin Newsom's successful 2003 mayoral run. It was a narrow race against Green Party candidate Matt Gonzalez. In creating a message for that campaign, Ross made the controversial decision to leave Newsom out of the TV commercials.
We used real people and people that had real expertise in issues to get up and speak for him, and used those as the messengers to drive the message that we needed to move voters in town. And part of the reason why is that, you know, while Gavin Newsom's an extraordinarily articulate, very charismatic politician, we actually found that that was a bit of an issue, that he was too charismatic, he was too good-looking, it was too much of that, and we needed to create a base under him that people would understand and be compelled by.
Poor guy, too good-looking to appear in his own TV spot.
Well, you know, I mean, that we would all have that problem. But sometimes the obvious choice is the wrong choice. So, you know, the first spot we did was Dr. Pablo Stewart talking about Gavin Newsom's homeless policy.
There's nothing progressive about giving money to people for the means that they're going to kill themselves. That is by drug and alcohol overdose. I think Supervisor Newsom's proposals and his leadership as mayor would start to move this process forward.
Of course, candidates usually don't have the luxury of simply promoting their own point of view. They have to respond to attacks from their opponents. Even then, Ross says, sometimes the best way to respond is not to.
I'll give you an example. We did the Oregon governor's race in 2006, and our opponent, Ron Saxton, spent millions of dollars hitting Ted Kulongoski, the governor of Oregon, on taxes and the issue of taxes. He wants to raise your taxes, he wants to raise your taxes, he wants to raise your taxes. We never ran away from that. Governor did want to raise taxes, but we didn't fall into the trap, or we didn't fall into the idea that we were going to debate him on that issue.
We've added 30,000 children to the Oregon Health Plan. We've added more money into the Smart Reading Program to teach young children to read. And we have done more through Jessica's Law to protect our children. I try to convey to them, the governor of this state is on your side.
We picked up the mantle on going after him or positioning the governor as somebody who shared Oregon's values, that people knew whose side he was on, who you could, you know, that you could trust him as somebody who was going to look out for you and for your interests. And that was able to overwhelm and to inoculate us from that tax attack.
Ross says this type of advertisement allowed the campaign to reframe the debate on its own terms.
There's an old saying in politics, when you're responding, you're losing. So the most important thing, and it always sounds simple, is to run your own campaign. Don't let your opponent run your campaign for you. The key is to always be defining yourself and driving your messaging forward. That's how you win.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Cornely.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're joined by George Lakoff. He's professor of linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's author of Thinking Points: Communicating Our American Values and Vision. George, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
A pleasure to be here, Ken.
George, you're not the only linguist who's gotten interested in politics. Noam Chomsky comes to mind, as well as Jeff Nunberg. But in your case, what was your route from nouns and verbs to politics and framing?
Well, in the 1994 campaign, I saw the conservatives mopping up against the progressives. And I wondered why, because I didn't understand what a conservative was. I didn't understand why the same people were for owning guns and also against abortion. I didn't see the connection. I didn't see the connection between that and being against taxes or being for tort reform. And I figured I had exactly the opposite positions on all these things. So I said, what are my positions? Why? What do they make sense to me? What brings them together? And I didn't understand it. But I did understand that it was in my field, cognitive science. And so I started out asking, what is the generalization behind conservative thought and progressive thought? And the answer came from the study of family values, which is that we think in terms of the nation as a family. And there are two types of families: a strict father family, which is the basis of conservative thought, a nurturing family, the basis of progressive thought. And the way you think in those families, characterizes how you think from one point or another. And we all have both points of view in this culture.
So let's step back a little bit before Newt Gingrich in 1994 catapulted you into politics and dig into this underlying idea of framing and cognition. I mean, basically, we think in terms of metaphors. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, something we should learn to avoid? How do we think of this?
Well, we can't avoid it, and it's basically it's who we are. And it's not just metaphors. We think in terms of frames, which have, what are called semantic roles. Mm-hmm. That is, if you think of a hospital, there are doctors and there are patients and there are orderlies and receptionists, and those are the roles that are played, and certain people do certain things. We understand a hospital in that way. That's a frame.
But isn't that because, wait a minute, isn't that because hospitals are that way? Because they're orderlies and patients and doctors? I mean, that's not automatic, is it? I mean, if we were in the, take our Eastern European thing, there would also be the officious bureaucrat who was overseeing the, right? But we don't think of that.
That's the hospital frame here. Those things can be different in culture to culture. And that's an important fact. That is, frames are not universal. Although some everyday ones, like grasping something or picking something up, probably is. But metaphorical thought is natural, and it's thought, not just language, and it comes before language. And it arises because of the way our brains are structured. If you take something like more is up, why do prices rise and fall and skyrocket and so on? If you pour more water into the glass, the level will go up. There's a correlation in your experience. Why do people, for example, speak of warm people and cold people as, affectionate and unaffectionate?
Right. So here's my underlying question for you, though, George. I mean, do we think of the world the way we think of it because we have the frames that we have, right, kind of antecedently, and we bring those frames to bear and we apply them all over the place, sometimes apply them where they're not sort of naturally suited, but I guess metaphor is like taking a frame over here and applying it there or something like that. Or do we have the frames that we have because we're confronted with the world that we're confronted with, structured as it's structured, and so our frames try to reflect something about the world.
So you're asking which came first, the chicken and the egg or the chicken and the egg frame?
Kind of, right.
Well, they came together, and that's the point. You can't just say it's objective or subjective. It's interactive. That is, we have bodies, we function in the world, we think with our brains, we have no choice but to think with our brains. Our brains are structured in a certain way. So, for example, if you're confronted with people pouring water into the glass and the level going up, you see that from the time you are born, in your brain sees it in two different places. Quantity and verticality are activated in two different places. You see it over and over, you get activation, spreading, connecting, forming a bridge,
okay,
and it's a metaphor.
Okay, I think I get it. But now, see, I was trying to drive this toward the political, because we're talking about politics and cognitive science. And so these political frames, nurturant mother and strict father.
Nurturant parent, not mother.
nurturant parent and strict, what was it?
Father.
Father. Okay, where do they come from? Is that because, is that because the world comes to us packaged? I mean, how were those formed to begin with?
I don't know, but they're not the same in all cultures, and that's what's interesting. There are different family structures, culture to culture. But what you do have in all cultures in general is that your first experience with governance is in your family, and that means what you do is you learn that a governing institution is a family, and around the whole world you have things like Mother India, Mother Russia, and so on.
Well, just to bring a little political philosophy and history into it, Locke and some of the others really based their conception of government on the father, right? I mean, that was supposed to be, I mean, it goes back to Aristotle, I guess. I'm a little weak on history, actually, but I know I've read these guys, and they start off with the father as kind of the natural authority, and then they think about how government is like that or not like that.
Well, that's the strict father model.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the only model that's been there. Historians are now looking at this, and it turns out that they're both strict and nurturant versions of government that go way back.
So these things are contestable and pliable, and they can change and evolve, and we don't quite understand the dynamics of them, but they're really important. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is politics and cognitive science. Our guest is George Lakoff from the University of California at Berkeley.
Sign a bill and help the board to show I'm not a snob. I'll open my door
If you want to grow up to be a politician, you better learn the art of framing. And if you want to be a good, wise, rational voter, you better learn to understand and decipher political framing. This is Philosophy Talk. The topic is cognitive science and politics, and I'm John Perry.
I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is George Lakoff from Berkeley. George, now, you say, and I think rightly, that conservative think tanks have become very successful at framing the leading issues of the day, and progressives have kind of lagged behind. How does this happen? Is there something sort of intrinsic to conservatives and progressives that it worked out this way?
Well, the conservatives had a plan, spent $4 billion over 35 years, hired lots of people, including marketing people, who understood how people think very well. Progressives have a false theory of reason, which comes from the fact that a lot of them went to college. They thought that
can screw you up for life.
It's terrible. They actually learned that that Enlightenment reason was behind the country, when it was really Enlightenment politics. And Enlightenment reason turns out in cognitive science to be false in every way. Here are the properties of Enlightenment reason very quickly. One, it's supposed to be conscious. Two, it's supposed to be dispassionate, unemotional. Three, it's supposed to just fit the world, be logical, be universal. Everybody's supposed to think the same way and supposed to be based on self-interest. It's all false. Well, every part of it has been shown in neuroscience and cognitive science in the last 30 years to be false.
Well, let's distinguish. I get your point, and you're right about that. Let's distinguish, though, enlightenment. Let's distinguish Enlightenment rationality from Enlightenment thinking. I mean, the process of thinking, you know, and moving from idea to idea is a mess. And you're right, cognitive science has shown us. But there's still something to be said for dispassionate, impersonal, logical rationality, because we subject all this yucky thinking that we do to rational criticism. And
it's wrong. Because what underlies your so-called rational criticism are frames, which is the normal way you think, metaphor, it's the normal way you think, and you can't be rational without emotion. For example, we know from studies of people who've had brain damage that if you lose your capacity to feel emotion, you don't know what to want. You don't know whether you'd like it, not like it, what other people would think about your actions, and you can't function rationally at all. Reason requires emotion.
Well, let me give you an example outside the political sphere to frame a question I want to ask. You and others have documented how the extent to which our thinking about time involves the metaphor of space and concepts like between, ahead, behind, so forth and so on. On the other hand, when we think about time, we limit the use of the metaphor. I don't say, well, you know, if you wanted to avoid the Bush administration, you should have taken a left about 1998. We know that left and right don't make much sense with regard to time. So given that we're going to think in metaphors, isn't there a rational and an irrational, a better or worse in kind of gauging how well the metaphor were? I mean, metaphors are useful because they give us this structure with all these roles already built in. But to apply it to a new sphere, you have to kind of, isn't there a process of deciding what's appropriate and what's inappropriate?
Well, you misunderstand metaphor. Metaphors don't map the entire structure of space. They map part of the structure, and that part is predictable from the neural theory of metaphor.
I want to get this back to political decision-making and thinking a bit, but I also want to invite our listeners to join this conversation, and you can do so by calling 415-841-4134, or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. We're talking about cognitive science and politics. So look, you've got this claim. It's a provocative claim that that those progressive liberals were a fan of Enlightenment rationality and conservatives, they were clued into the reality of how the human mind works, and they got onto the bandwagon of trying to figure out how people actually are moved, and then that's why they're so good at this. Do I got you roughly right?
Well, I think the conservative think tanks did. It's very roughly right. There's a lot more to it than that, but only very roughly. But I think the main point is 98% of our thought is unconscious. It's what our brain is doing when we're not aware of it.
So if I think like a conservative, help me think about why does that help me win the day? in political decision, in political argument. Tell me more about why the conservatives are, give me some examples of why the conservatives are so good at this and the progressives so bad because they were stuck in the Enlightenment.
Well, for example, they have repeated over and over, they know repetition changes your brain, that, you know, government is supposed to be small, it gets in the way, it hurts you, whereas the progressive idea is that government is about empathy, about caring for people, we take care of each other, we are responsible in doing that, and that means that government has two functions. It has protection and empowerment as functions, and, you know, that means not just military protection, but environmental protection, worker protection, and empowerment is not just building roads and schools, but supporting a banking system and a court system and all of that that allows any business to function. And taxes are what you pay to live in America as opposed to, say, Chad or Bangladesh. Now, that is not said by any progressive politician. The conservatives understand their ideas, which are very different, and they say it over and over and over.
Well, that in the Roving Philosophical Reporter, where the candidate was being attacked for wanting to raise taxes, the consultant said, "Yeah, we wanted to raise taxes, but we didn't address it that way." He basically talked about all the benefits that would come from raising taxes.
More than that,
what we did is this and this and this, and how we were on your side.
He did better than that. What he did was focus on empathy. What he did and protection. He listed all the things that would guarantee empowerment and protection and spoke from the perspective of empathy, of caring for other people. That what that does is activate the empathy part of people's brains. And if you are biconceptual, if you have, and we all are, we have both conservative, strict father and nurturing parent modes of thought, what that does is activate the empathetic or progressive mode of thought in voters.
415-841-4134. That's how you can join this conversation. And Don in Portola Valley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Don.
Thank you. I was wondering, you're always using the word here, progressive. Do you think that that might co-opt a perfectly good English word, progress, which is inherently non-political, and that the progressives, you're using that word constantly on your program, do you think that's a very clever way of co-opting a basically positive word and giving it a political context?
Well, and one of the interesting parts of that is that people who use the word conservative are co-opting a perfectly reasonable word to conserve things, whereas contemporary conservatism is quite radical. It wants to change things in an authoritarian direction or a direction in which corporate America runs the country.
But keep going. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and that's important. That is, the word conservative does not mean conserve necessarily anything, but there's a mythology, let's say, that they're conserving the original meaning of the Constitution or something like that, which they're not. They're changing the meaning of the Constitution all the time.
Well, I agree with you about conservatism. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, I was raised a conservative in Nebraska, and back then it meant, you know, avoiding foreign wars and balancing the budget. But progressive, I must say, that's not my favorite word. The frame that it suggests in my mind is, well, you know, technology keeps changing so that you can't understand it. The print gets smaller and smaller as devices get smaller and smaller. Things that used to be simple, like telephones, now have 20 or 30 buttons on them that you can't figure out. I mean, screw progressivism. I mean, can't we find a better word than that?
I like progressive, and I like the progressivism, because I like progress, and especially social, political progress. You know, the emancipation of the slaves, the enfranchisement of blacks and women, the breaking down of barriers. That's where the progressives stand, if you look at the history. Now, there was a point in history, in political history, not so long ago, when liberal became a swear word, and the reason it became a swear word is because the liberals were running everything when everything started falling apart, when the economy went in the tank, when the war in Vietnam turned out into a disaster, a quagmire that, I mean, it was JFK and LBJ who got us into that. And of course, Nixon didn't, you know, but kept us in it.
Once you had slavery, getting rid of it is progress. But there was a time when the institution of the slave trade, oh, that's great progress. Now we can get sugar from the Indies. There's nothing particularly good about progress. Basically, it's a pain in the butt.
What you got in America is an idea of Not only human rights, but progress toward those rights.
Right.
And, you know, human rights were built into the Constitution. They were not anywhere near perfect when we started out, and the idea is to get closer and closer to them. And that's what progress is about. It's toward getting closer and closer to the American ideals.
Right. So that's a great word for liberals to claim as their own, I think. 415-841-4134. Join this conversation, and Greg and Palo Alto is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Greg.
Hello, thank you. My question is that it seems to me that Mr. Lakoff's, the result of Mr. Lakoff's ideas is to promote the manipulation of people based on one kind of metaphor versus another kind of metaphor. But what I'd like to see is that we want to promote critical thinking in which the voters are able to use their own thought processes in order to tell when they're being manipulated either by one metaphor or the other. And my worry is that this kind of thing just, we are replicating the conservative deception of using metaphor to manipulate people's minds rather than encouraging and teaching critical thinking so they can decide for themselves which metaphor they want to choose or whether they recognize that a metaphor is being passed upon.
Greg, thanks for the call. That's an excellent question. Greg is a defender of Enlightenment rationality against your...
Absolutely. Yeah. He hasn't read the books because, in fact, the books are a way to do exactly what you say. I've now written 5 books on this subject, and the idea, and they're all out in public, and the idea is to show exactly what everyone is doing and to promote the idea among progressives that they should say what they believe, not to say things they don't believe. There's a difference between framing and spin. Spin is using framing, which is the ordinary way that we people think and talk, to get out of embarrassing situations politically. Framing is just saying what you believe effectively.
But still, there's still this worry, George, that the frame obscures certain things and highlights other things. And when we're moved by the frame, we can be blind to, well, let's call it the frame invariant realities, right? And we should really be learn to cue ourselves into the frame invariant realities and not to let the politicians just select out certain aspects of this thing to highlight and manipulate.
I agree entirely. And what I've been writing about is how to tell the truth by framing, because people, a lot of Democrats think that if you just say, let's say 47 million people don't have health care, the conservatives come back and say, well, they don't deserve it. They haven't worked hard enough. The point is that a progressive will say it's the role of this country to make sure everyone is protected. It's protection and empowerment, and health care is protection. This is something that has to do with what you believe and what the country is about, and saying what you believe, and simply giving the statistics doesn't tell you anything.
Robert in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Robert.
Oh, hi. How are you? My question was if you could elaborate a bit of beyond the discussion of politics as marketing and developing ways of presenting political frames to the public in a marketing campaign, and does this approach go to more civic involvement and democratic engagement rather than just how do you package a candidate's message?
Well, before we let Professor Lakoff answer that, let me just make a point that if you go back to Aristotle, you had the study of rhetoric. That was an honorable study. I mean, Plato thought it could be abused, but still the idea was that if you have a democracy, I mean, you have a civic-minded person, they need to learn how to persuade. So I want to put Lakoff not in the merchandising area, but in this honorable tradition. So go ahead.
That's exactly the point. Our job is to teach people exactly how this works, and that's what all of my books do. They'd say, if you believe this, say what you exactly believe and tell the truth. And you need framing to tell the truth.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing politics and cognitive science with George Lakoff from UC Berkeley.
We've been discussing the basic cognitive process of framing and how some politicians have learned to use it and advance their causes and others haven't learned so well. Do you have some ideas for effectively using frames for the positions you hold? Have you been misled by frames? Share your experiences with us and you can get an expert's reaction to your ideas. Politics, Cognitive Science and Framing. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is George Lakoff from the University of California at Berkeley.
George, you're associated with the Rock Ridge Institute. That's a good, strong-sounding name, Rock Ridge, which seeks to enhance the understanding of framing and political decision-making and has, if I might say so, a distinctively progressive position. What are the goals of the Institute? To get beyond framing or to get better at it?
The goals of the Institute are to have you understand it and to have you understand exactly how every issue gets framed, but also how the deep concepts get framed. If you look at conservatives, they have framed government, they have framed security, they have framed taxes, they have framed the market, they have framed nature, they have framed responsibility. And in their way, in a way that fits the way they think and what their values are. And progressives have views on all of these things, but largely unconscious and largely unarticulated. Our job is to figure out exactly how conservatives do it, how progressives do it, and how what we call neoliberals do it.
But, you know, the thing that worries me about this is not a theorist or thinker, but as a citizen and voter, is that... Okay, here all you guys are in your institute trying to understand, you know, how the mind works. And it's just like market science in a way. I mean, marketing people understand a lot about what moves people. But then it gets in the hands of the marketers, and what do? They manipulate us. They delude us. So helping the politicians understand and the political operators understand this is one thing. But what about us, the voter, and helping us kind of be a pawn in this frame war?
Well, that's exactly what I and the Rock Ridge Institute are about. We're trying to get the voter beyond that. We're trying to get ordinary citizens to understand what is happening, to ask themselves what they really believe and why they believe it, and how they can talk about what they really believe and why what they hear may not fit what they believe and why they may be outraged by what they hear.
So, see, there's two different things, though, right? Because you talk about how progressives or liberals haven't been so good at this and they need to learn the trick and learn the tricks of the trade and understand the way human thinking really works, you know. That's one thing. But then me, the citizen, trying to decide, okay, I'm presented with one thing framed as this way and one thing framed as that way, what am I to do?
You're to look at it and read our website and read our publications and read the books I've been writing and see exactly why, where this framing comes from, what values are behind them, what kind of reasoning is behind them, and do you accept those values or not? That is the point. You got to understand your values, and it confronts you with your values, just as philosophy always has.
But isn't there room for some non-metaphorical, non-frame discussion once you get clear about what the value alternatives are? Do we want a government that's based on the father? Or do we want a government that's based on the nurturing parent? Do we want a national government that is in charge of health care? Or do we want to leave it to the states? There's room for these things.
Isn't there room for something else to say, well, look, this frame, nurturing parent versus strict father, that's so inadequate to characterize the real choices that face us. I mean, this is about real stuff and real lives. It's not about, you know, how I construe these in kind of loosely metaphorical terms. That's not really about that. That's not very deep.
That's not what metaphor is about. What metaphor shows you is it's, first of all, not just about the nation. It's about any governing institution. And there's a mode of thought that you learn in your families. And that mode of thought can be put on the market. It can be put on religion. It can be put on social institutions, whether it's a little league team or a national government. And what we're trying to do is show exactly what the values and modes of thought are so people can understand them and see how they feel about them and question their own views, if that's appropriate, or find out what they really deeply feel.
415-841-4134. We still got time for some callers if you want to join this scintillating conversation. So, you know, let's go back to this Enlightenment rationality and all this stuff again, just briefly, of which I'm still a fan, even though I grant the results of cognitive science. One of the things that kind of view of thinking and reasoning said was, we can always adopt a critical distance from all these things that are thrown at us. Right? There's some point of view from which we can criticize and evaluate that's kind of free of all that stuff. You don't believe that. Right?
That's one of the things that we learned from cognitive science and neuroscience. There is no such thing. You have a brain. You've learned frames. You can't think or talk without using frames. You have learned hundreds of what we call primary metaphors before you even learn to walk or talk. You've learned lots of modes of thought that you don't even know are there,
right,
and that are structuring your understanding of the world. Our job is to make you aware of what's in your own mind.
So, but now I'm trying to figure out how much am I, you make me aware of what's in my own mind, how much am I stuck with that? How much can I kind of do cognitive reform? Because some of this frame thinking, you know, Kahneman and Tversky are famous for showing how we can get taken to the cleaners by the way we frame things, right? What kind of capacity do I have to reform and improve my own kind of reasoning and tracking the truth and all that?
That's why you do some science. The idea of neuroscience and cognitive science is to allow you to learn how you think, how other people think, and what your limits are. There are limits. You can't just think anything.
Well, I mean, if you're doing math, though, I mean, math is loaded with metaphors, but still, at some point, the mathematician gets beyond the metaphor and actually proves something, right?
No.
Oh.
You can prove, remember, what metaphor does is preserve inference. It preserves reasoning. And it's frame-based reasoning and metaphor-based reasoning all the way down to math. Rafael Nunez and I have a book called Where Mathematics Comes From. And it's about 600 pages, starting with the neuroscience and cognitive science, and showing the metaphorical basis of not just simple mathematics, but higher mathematics.
You know, George, I would probably want to argue with you at some length about this, because I don't think I share your views about those kind of things, but I found some of your stuff very enlightening. But, you know, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Our guest has been George Lakoff. He's professor of linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Thinking Points, Communicating Our American Values and Vision. So, John, what did we learn today?
Well, we learned that George Lakoff is just what we expected he would be, lively, intelligent, full of ideas. You can take the linguist out of Berkeley and put him in politics, and it's still pretty interesting. Also learned that our callers, very good questions today, stubbornly refusing to just
abandon
the Enlightenment ideal.
Yeah, I agree with you. But, you know, John, I think this Lakoff stuff is very, very fascinating. I mean, I think there's a lot to it. I think he's right that cognitive science, I'd put it this way, as cognitive science has shown that the human mind is a mess, right? We reason in all these sort of ways that don't really track the truth or the objectively good and all that. And you might wonder where I thought that we ever did reason that way came from. So there is that. But there's still a small voice in me.
One thing that's clear, there's a huge gap between the models of thinking and inference that we study in philosophy, even though they've gotten a lot more into visual reasoning and metaphors and what the cognitive science like Lakoff are telling us.
Yeah, but that gap is diminishing, you know. But this conversation continues, as always, or as often, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our model is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well.
Yeah, and do that and help keep Philosophy Talk on the air. And joining us now, our own Merle Kessler.
Hi.
A.K.A. Ian Shows, the 60-Second Philosopher, along with KALW's General Manager, Matt Martin, to tell you, we're going to all tell you how you can become part of this lovely family of ours.
That's right. This is your last opportunity to show your support for Philosophy Talk during this spring membership drive. You know, I know that the conversation continues on the blog, but the conversation continues on KALW every Sunday morning because people like you, hey, you make the decision to make the call and show your support. 800-525-9917. We've got a great thank you gift, George Lakoff's Thinking Points. If you haven't spent time with one of George Lakoff's books, don't accept the taglines about what George Lakoff is talking about. You can read it for yourself, get a deeper understanding. That's for a $60 pledge or for a $100 pledge. Merle?
I will leave a message on your answering machine.
A message from God. Well,
yeah,
God.
Like even though personally I'm message free,
yeah,
it'll be the message of your choice.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. I want to tell you something. Now, I since coming into public radio, I've learned something. Something like 1 out of 9 listeners gets up and donates at these pledge breaks. You know, that means that 8 out of 9 of you are freeloaders. You don't want to be a freeloader. If you're the kind of person who listens to KLW, I'm sure that you're a civic-minded, responsible, community-oriented person. That means you have to do your part. That means you have to get off your duff and dial in at 1-800-525-9917. Make a pledge at whatever level you can. You know, for $60, you'll get Lakoff's book, something points? I've been talking about it
talking
all day.
Thinking points.
Or for $100, you'll get Merle Kessler, aka Ian Scholes, leaving
a pointed message on your answering machine.
Or for $100 for the bargain price of what was it?
$125.
You'll get both. Mm-hmm. And that's to thank you for doing what you ought to do. Get off your duff and not be a freeloader. Because if you want to keep the station going, you have to keep it going.
You know, this time of year, you might think, what a horrible time to try to raise money. We're all thinking about paying our taxes. But there's another way to look at it. When I pay my taxes, which I just did, I get out that charitable deductions thing, and I get out all my forms. And when I see that I've donated money to public radio, that's one of the things I feel best about. It's one of the things where I said, you know, I could have given more, and I should have given more. Now, if you're paying your taxes and you don't have a KALW slot there under charitable deductions, come on, guy, you're not doing your share. And it is deductible, I think. So get off your duff and phone this number.
800-525-9917. Or if you already have your duff in front of your computer, you want to go to KALW.org. Very simple there. You can take one of these thank you gifts, the George Lakoff book, Thinking Points, the message from Merle for a $100 pledge. Get them both for $125. $125 to keep this forum for intelligent, spirited, prickly sometimes conversation on the air. If that's something you tune in for, now's the time to show your support.
And even, you know, so if you're on your duff or off your duff, now is the time to call.
Yeah, and if you're duff-free.
You're duff-free.
It's time to call. But let me tell you something. You know, John and I, we had this idea for radio philosophy on the radio, and we met up with Ben Manila at this big conference where most people were giving us the cold shoulder, and Ben and John and I came to various places and said, we want to do philosophy on the radio. And they said, yeah. Oh, come on. And then we came to KLW, and we talked to Nicole Sawaya, Matt's very fine predecessor, and she said, you want to do philosophy on the radio? That sounds like a great idea. Let's give it a try. I mean, we weren't quite radio ready. We've kind of perfected the art, and we've improved the art. We've made a unique art. Yeah. And then Matt said, when Matt took over, he said, keep going, guys, keep going. You've got to reward that kind of innovation, risk-taking, openness to new ideas. There aren't many outlets that have that kind of openness and risk-taking. San Francisco has a unique institution, and you want to keep it going. And to keep it going, dial 1-800-525-9917.
That's right.
And, you know, if I was out there, I'd be thinking, I got to come up with some message that's so embarrassing for Merle Kessler to read that he really resists doing it. And it'll be worth, $120, $160,
$2,000?
Only $100? Oh, my gosh, that's amazing.
And I just think about the great conversations that Philosophy Talk has about, I mean, I think that this is one of the only places where you'll hear an hour, what is infinity? And I got to say, when I heard that, I thought, well, how can you talk about that for an hour? But then I listened. And if that's been your experience, once you listen,
Matt, you can talk about infinity forever.
but not and stay interested.
First you talk about it for half an hour, and then you talk about it for 15 minutes, and then you talk about it for 7.5 minutes. And if you keep doing that, eventually, I guess you'll never quite make it, will you?
You know, there's this great Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song, Chicago. Won't you please come to Chicago for the help that you can bring? There's a line in it that says, don't ask Jack to help you because you turn the other ear. No one else can take your part. No one else can take your part. Don't let the guy next to you do it. You've got to do it. 1-800-525-9917.
Or you can go online at KALW.org. However you do it, you keep John and Ken and their team on the air here, keeping this space for intelligent, thoughtful conversation that brings you in. That's what we're about here. You make it possible. So come and join us right now at 800-525-9917.
And you know, folks, I'm not just a big radio star that you hear every week when you're playing hooky from church. I'm also a regular KALW listener. And, you know, it's a great station. You can hear jazz. You can hear they call it the global local station because you hear a lot of local stuff made right here in San Francisco. But you also hear the BBC. You hear this great show from Canada whose name I can't remember that really gives you
as it happens.
An interesting perspective on what our neighbors up north are doing. It's just such a great radio station, and I'm happy to pay my bucks every so often for it.
Yeah, and I mean, the point is it's a lot of people getting together. Everyone here is a listener as well as someone who makes the radio. We just ask you to join us in keeping it going. 800-525-9917.
1-800-525-9917. This is a great station. I really believe in this. I believe in the people who work here. I didn't know what it was like behind the scenes until I became part of it. You meet all these dedicated, thoughtful, energetic, tireless people, and you've got to reward all this risk-taking, all this energy. This is a unique institution. There aren't many like it around the country. 1-800-525-9917.
KALW said yes to Philosophy Talk. We ask you to say yes to KALW.
Oh, that's a great one. You say yes. And the way you say yes is getting off your duff.
Ka-ching.
Dialing 1-800-525-9917 and making a donation at whatever level you care to.
As we say nowadays, yes, we can. Yes, we can support KALW.
Yeah. What's the Spanish of that?
Si se puede.
Si se puede, if you like Spanish. And I'd like to thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting KALW.